morning, President Trump admits prices are too high, but blames Democrats. He has a few ideas to lower prices, which sound a lot like plans Democrats have proposed. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Just how high are prices? Inflation is steady, but higher than the Federal Reserve wants. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez. We hear from Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee about the data and Trump's attacks on the Fed's independence. Also, what questions did Supreme Court justices ask in the case over bans to transgender athletes in school sports, and how might they eventually rule? It's Wednesday, January 14th. Today, 1973, the Miami Dolphins won Super Bowl VII and are still the only NFL team to have a perfect unbeaten season. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Vice President J.D. Vance are due to meet with the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland at the White House today. NPR's Jackie Northam reports these talks come as President Trump has repeatedly said he wants to acquire Greenland.
Denmark and Greenland requested the meeting with Secretary Rubio, who has tried to tamp down President Trump's increasingly aggressive remarks about wanting ownership of Greenland for national security reasons, even if it means by military force. Trump recently said if the U.S. doesn't take the semi-autonomous territory, Russia or China will, adding the U.S. can take it the easy way or the hard way. Analysts believe any such move would split the NATO alliance. Denmark and Greenland have rejected pressure from the White House ahead of the meeting with Rubio and Vice President Vance. Denmark has offered to work with the U.S. to beef up security in the Arctic. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Top prosecutors in Minneapolis have resigned over the Trump administration's handling of the shooting death of Renee Good by an ICE agent. That includes the second-in-command, Joe Thompson. This comes after the Justice Department pushed the Minnesota U.S. Attorney's Office to investigate Good's widow. Thompson also objected to the Justice Department's decision to exclude Minnesota officials from the investigation. This as protests around the country continue. Julio Murphy Zelaya is with the ACLU in Minnesota. He says free speech has to be protected.
Folks are gathering peacefully across not just the Twin Cities, but across the state, joined by other cities across the nation. And so I'm confident that our voices will be heard.
Speaking there to ABC News. China has posted a record $1.2 trillion trade surplus for the last year, meaning it's exporting much more than it buys from other countries. NPR's Emily Fang reports this is despite the Trump administration's tariffs on Chinese goods.
China's record trade surplus for the last year shows how Beijing has successfully found new markets outside of the U.S. to export to. Exports to the U.S. declined by a fifth last year. Chinese officials said the surplus showed how China was diversifying who it trades with. But the surplus also shows how China remains reliant on exports to fuel its economic growth. And consumer demand inside China is still plateauing. Its leaders want to move away from just manufacturing consumer goods to becoming a profitable global leader in high-tech goods and things like semiconductors and energy, while also tackling ongoing issues of debt among its local governments and property construction companies. Emily Fang, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. Dow futures are down about 0.3%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In Thailand, at least 25 people are dead, dozens of others injured, after a construction crane fell on a moving train. Officials say there were around 200 passengers and crew on board that train, northeast of Bangkok. The crane was part of the construction of an elevated high-speed railway over the track that, when completed, will extend from Thailand to China. The cause of the collapse is under investigation. Crew 11 astronauts are coming back to Earth today early after one of them experienced an undisclosed health concern. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, it's the first time NASA has cut short an International Space Station mission for medical reasons.
NASA officials have stressed that the unidentified astronaut is stable, but say they need to do the kind of full diagnostic workup that's only possible on the ground. In a video beamed down from the station earlier this week, everyone on board spoke on camera, and none appeared obviously ill. NASA astronaut Zena Cardman is on the four-person crew coming home early.
Our timing of this departure is unexpected, but what was not surprising to me was how well this crew came together as a family to help each other and just take care of each other.
The crew's SpaceX capsule should splash down off the coast of California early Thursday morning. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Asian markets mostly higher by the close. The Nikkei, the main market in Japan, up 1.5%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Choral, a film starring Ralph Fiennes as a choir master in 1916 England, determined to lead a local choral society as war rages, opens Friday in theaters.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
The University and Snelling intersection in St. Paul is one of the busiest in Minnesota. It's hard to believe that centuries ago, this was a wild land, abundant in wildlife, where the Dakota communities hunted, traveled, and lived. Now 50,000 cars come through this intersection every day. In the mid-1800s, the Dakota were forcibly removed to open the land for European settlers. The new arrivals needed an easy way to get around, so a streetcar system was built. Soon, it was transporting 100 million people a year at a whopping 5 cents a ride. By the 1950s, cars and buses had gained popularity, and the streetcar took its last ride. Interstate 94 was built, creating more commercial businesses. In 2014, the light rail was built along University Avenue. Today, the site is under development, with a soccer stadium, apartments, a playground, and a 33-foot-tall loon sculpture honoring our state bird. So the next time you're stuck at a red light at University and Snelling, imagine that car next to you is a cow grazing the land in the 1800s.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Voters say affordability is a top concern, so it makes sense that the economy is expected to be one of the main issues in this year's midterm elections.
President Trump has started traveling around the country giving speeches about the economy. He was at the Detroit Economic Club on Tuesday, although he did not exactly stay on topic.
And now, after less than 12 months in office, this is the easiest speech to make. I have great people, and all I'm doing is spewing off what the hell we've done. Even Venezuela wasn't too bad, was it, huh?
NPR's senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith is here to break it all down. Tam, the president is kind of proud of what he calls the weave. Is that what we just heard here?
Yes, it is. He was really all over the place in this speech, changing topics mid-sentence and boasting about being off the teleprompter 80% of the time. The speech included insults from more than half a dozen politicians, Republicans and Democrats alike. And then there was his impression of his predecessor.
Remember the speeches Joe would make? First of all, they'd last a matter of seconds, you know. Thank you very much. You ever notice Joe would always cough before a speech? State of the Union, he gets,
And picture the president making contorted facial expressions to go along with the sound effects.
Okay, so beyond the impersonations, what did the president actually say about the economy?
First off, he said it is great. He boasted that grocery prices are, quote, starting to go rapidly down. That was on the same day that the government announced that in December, grocery prices had their biggest spike since 2022. He went into some detail about his view that when gas prices come down, other prices will come down as well. Of Fed Chair Jerome Powell, he said that jerk will be gone soon. And then he teased new proposals.
In the coming weeks, I will be laying out even more plans to help bring back affordability. And again, remember, that's a fake word
by Democrats, prices were too high. They caused the high price.
And these regular riffs about affordability being a con job or a fake word really risk undercutting his message and are also out of line with the pain that people say they're feeling.
Trump mentioned laying out even more plans. Any idea what those plans are?
He said he's going to outline a proposal at the World Economic Forum in Davos next week to bring down home prices by getting private equity companies out of the U.S. housing market. And Trump has started talking about a plan to cap credit card interest rates at 10% for a year. Thus far, he is just talking about asking the companies to voluntarily make that change. And yes, these absolutely sound like ideas you've heard before from Democrats, not Republicans. Trump even called Senator Elizabeth Warren this week to talk ideas. But the response from Republicans on the Hill has been pretty tepid so far.
Okay. Now, one other thing happened at the Ford truck plant that Trump toured before the speech, and it involved the president giving the middle finger.
Yeah, TMZ posted a video of the incident. Someone shouted what sounded like pedophile protector, presumably about the Epstein files. In response, Trump appeared to mouth an expletive, then gave the middle finger to the person who was shouting. In a statement, White House Communications Director Stephen Chung said, quote, "A lunatic was wildly screaming expletives in a complete fit of rage, and the president gave an appropriate and unambiguous response."
Okay, NPR's Tamara Keith, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Well, what do voters think about the president's economic performance? Margie Omero joins us next. She's with the public opinion firm GBAO and a longtime strategist for Democrats. And we called her because she spends time in focus groups with voters. Margie, good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome back. For those who don't follow this every day, what is a focus group and why do you talk to voters that way?
Well, it's a great way to hear voters talk in their own words, answer questions in their own words, and tell personal stories. So we do them online since COVID, or we do them in person. You have, you know, between 5 to 10 people in a room or in a Zoom, just answering questions. And so we start with things that are pretty open, like fill in the blank. What's one word that tells you, you know, I think blank is going well in the country these days. How would you fill in the blank? And people have been saying for a while now, nothing. There's nothing going well. Or if push, they'll say, well, maybe television is going well. That's their sense of how the country is. And so when you ask people about their own lives and how they feel personally, they'll tell you really very specific, acute stories of economic struggle, like living with their parents or living with their kids or not being able to afford food or thinking of moving to a place where utility prices are lower or have to use a buy now, pay later app to afford dog food. I mean, we hear some really, really tough stories. People tear up or cry. I've had people had to leave the room because they get overwhelmed thinking about the pain that they're in. And so when you have the president say, affordability is not even a word. It just flies in the face of what voters tell me, you know, nearly every week.
The president also said inflation is defeated. I guess we should note it's lower than it was. Prices are still high for a lot of people. People don't feel that people don't feel better about prices.
No, I mean, you do hear some people talk about gas prices, that part you hear, but for the most part, people say things are not going well. And you have folks who are skeptical of the president who feel very, very strongly, and you have the supporters who feel, you know, conflicted. Maybe it's okay, or I wish she was better, or this was not what I was hoping for, or, you know, I was worried it would be this bad, and now it's actually worse. We hear a wide range of folks, even from his own supporters, and for sure we hear people across the board say that the costs are going up, and there's no sense that there's going to be stability around the corner. People they're not excited. They're not rooting for chaos.
Now, I want to ask about something else, because the president, during his ramble yesterday, also talked about the protests in Minnesota against his deployment of immigration agents and also, of course, the shooting of Renee Macklin Good. Let's listen to some of that.
And one of the reasons they're doing these fake riots, I mean, they're just terrible. I mean, you see, it's so fake. Shame, shame, shame. You see the woman. That's all practice. They go practice. They go to areas. They take hotel rooms and they all practice together. It's a whole scam. We're finding out who's funding all this stuff, too. We pretty much know.
I just want to remind people of the news as we understand it, according to a source talking to one of our reporters. federal prosecutors have resigned because they were told to investigate not the agent who shot Renee Macklin Good, but instead to investigate her widow, to try to find dirt on the widow. And of course, the administration has portrayed the agent as completely innocent in every way. How do people respond to that incident and the videos they may well have seen themselves in focus groups?
Yeah, well, we're still learning about where voters are on this. Polls show that people disapprove of the way ICE handled that situation. It has come up in focus groups we've done since the incident where people feel like, you know, disgusted and ashamed of what happened and outraged. And we'll see how that continues. I don't think that the president is offering anything to counter those feelings. You know, the fact that, I mean, it's just something that people have a very consistent reaction to. And when people say they've heard something negative about the president in the last week, we've seen in polling, that comes to the top. That's the news that they're getting out of him. And in addition to, you know, and I think it, obviously it's a different type of story, but when you look at his speech, He goes to make an economic speech, and what really encapsulates how he feels about the American public than giving the finger, and that ends up being like the main news story out of his speech. And you add that to what's happening in Minneapolis, and I'm not equating them, but just a sign of, like, you know, real rejection of the American voter, like really, like, just putting yourself at odds and insulting the American voter in a way that, you know, people, you know, are hearing loud and clear.
Margie O'Meara of the public opinion firm GBAO, thanks as always.
Thank you so much.
The Environmental Protection Agency used to assign a dollar figure to many of its regulations. How much money would they cost compared to the monetary value of its benefits? Now that's changing. Here's NPR's Alejandra Burunda.
The EPA and other agencies have long been required to assess the potential impacts of rules they're introducing or changing.
EPA has historically sort of looked at all of the costs and all the benefits of its regulations.
That's Jeffrey Homestead. He's an environmental lawyer at Bracewell LLC, and he used to lead EPA's Office of Air and Radiation under George W. Bush. So how does EPA do the math? They calculate the cost to the polluting industry to clean up. They compare that to the potential benefits of the rule, like better health. Often they put a dollar value on both, and that makes it easier to figure out the value of a regulation. Homestead says the agency has been doing it for decades.
EPA has since that time been attributing a very high monetized benefit number to reducing emissions of fine particles, also known as PM2.5.
That translates to hundreds of billions of dollars a year in savings. That's because
reducing exposure to fine particulate matter pollution improves health.
That's Mary Rice. She's a lung doctor and air pollution expert at Harvard University. Fine particles, or soot, are really bad for people's health. She says they cause some 50,000 premature deaths each year in the U.S.
PM2.5 also increases risk of heart attack and stroke, increased risk of asthma and bronchitis attacks in kids and adults.
EPA says it's not ignoring the health benefits from air regulations, but it's no longer going to put a dollar value on them. The agency writes past calculations haven't been precise enough. But that decision could make it easier to loosen air regulations. That's according to Richard Revez. He's a New York University environmental law expert. Revez says rollbacks can look good.
But it looks good only because you ignore the main consequence of the rollback, which is the additional negative impact on public health.
Revez says the Trump EPA has done this before. It has chosen not to count up the economic benefits of cutting greenhouse gases, for example. EPA says they're refining the methods for calculating economic benefits. But the timeline for that is open-ended. Alejandra Burunda, NPR News.
This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
This is People Powered KAXC, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota. And sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to KEXC.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From Clarivate, sponsors of the Pulse of the Library 2025, a global survey of academic, public, and national libraries on AI's impact and evolving priorities. The survey can be explored at clarivate.com. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. The conservative majority on the Supreme Court seems likely to uphold state bans banning transgender girls and women from team sports at publicly funded schools. 27 states have those bans. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports on the court's arguments, which lasted over 3 hours.
First, the facts. Two transgender girls, one who was then in fifth grade in West Virginia and one who was in college in Idaho, wanted to be part of their school track teams. But state law barred them from participating. So they went to court, contending that their respective state laws violate both the Constitution's guarantee to equal protection of the law and the federal law barring sex discrimination in sports. At the Supreme Court on Tuesday, though, that was a tough sell, and while all the justices had lots of questions, the questioning was dominated by Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch, probably because of their personal connections to these issues. Gorsuch, after all, surprised many in 2020 when he authored the court's decision holding that gay and transgender individuals are protected under the federal law banning employment discrimination based on sex. As for Kavanaugh, he is a huge sports fan who has long coached his daughter's and other girls' basketball teams.
I mean, I hate that a kid who wants to play sports might not be able to play sports. Hate that. It's kind of a zero-sum game for a lot of teams.
But at the same time, he asked repeatedly whether individual states should make the decision on who gets to play. Justice Gorsuch, for his part, posed many difficult hypotheticals. Here's one about academic performance.
When it comes to high school performance, girls are sure a lot better than boys, and so we're only going to have remedial classes for boys, and girls aren't free to attend.
Justice Amy Coney Barrett had a tougher question.
So how would your theory play out if we're talking about six-year-olds, where there's no difference between boys and girls in terms of athletic ability, testosterone levels, etc.?
At the end of the day, it was unclear whether the court would write a narrow or broad opinion, the latter likely incentivizing a lot more restraints on transgender individuals. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Amy Howe was also listening to the arguments. She is the co-founder of SCOTUS Blog, which covers the Supreme Court. Amy, welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're with us. As I listened to the audio of the justices, I was reminded of something about this issue. We're constantly told by partisans on either side, this is simple and obvious, and you are evil and horrible if you do not agree entirely with me. And yet it sounded to me like the justices were wrestling with some of the complexities of the specific situation of girls' sports of different ages and how the law should apply to them. What did you hear?
I think that's right. And I think that you know, if you really want to look at this from the 35,000 foot level, you know, the justices like to say that oral argument is only a very small part of the process. And that's one of the justifications that they raise for not televising oral arguments. That, you know, they say we get a lot of briefs. But, you know, I think that this case is one where you see that the oral argument perhaps really matters. They were wrestling with these issues in real time. And I think the oral arguments show that they were trying to figure out how broadly or how narrowly their ruling is going to apply.
Oh, this is really interesting. There's the old saying that lawyers should only ask questions they already know the answers to. But I think you're telling me that these lawyers, justices on the bench, were asking questions that they maybe did not fully know the answers to.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that a lot of these were genuine questions.
With that said, what did you hear that made you write a prediction that the court is likely to uphold the laws which would ban trans athletes from girls' sports?
You know, I think that the if you sort of do a head count, you know, Justices Samuel Alito and Justice Thomas were relatively quiet. But on the other hand, back when Becky Pepper Jackson, who was the plaintiff in one of the cases, came to the court a couple of years ago asking the justices to allow her to compete in girls' sports while the litigation continued, they dissented from the court's decision to let her go ahead. And, you know, it seemed like the justices were likely to uphold these laws, but really not decide much else. They've got a lot of issues coming down the pike involving, you know, as they said, locker rooms and bathrooms and passport policies and transgender military members. And, you know, they, I think, are uninclined to say anything that's going to necessarily decide those cases. But Hashim Mupan, in particular, who was a lawyer representing the Trump administration, said, you can decide this on a very narrow ground, which is that there are regulations issued under federal law that bans sex discrimination in education institutions that receive federal funding that specifically authorize teams separated by sex, which means biological sex, and everybody agrees on that. So the justices, he said, don't need to get into issues around whether or not, you know, athletes like Becky Pepper Jackson and Lindsay Hecox, the plaintiff in the Idaho case, have some sort of advantage or lack of advantage. You can just rule on the issue of this statute.
Oh, and leave everything, what, for another day,
another case? For another day. Kick the can down the road, which, you know, the justices, you know, sometimes they do like to issue these sweeping rulings, but sometimes they like to kick the can down the road and deal with it another time.
Did you learn anything listening to these questions that maybe you didn't know about the justices' concerns, thoughts, or ideas on this issue?
You know, it was interesting because Justice, as Nina's story, as Nina's piece said, Justice Gorsuch has been kind of, you know, back and forth on this. He wrote the court's decision in Bostock on federal employment discrimination laws protecting LGBTQ employees. But then he joined the court's decision last year in a case called United States versus Scrimeti, allowing Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for minors. Mm-hmm. But he was the conservative justice who seemed most likely to side with the plaintiffs in this case. So we'll see.
Interesting. Amy Howe is co-founder of SCOTUS Blog. Thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
What will the ousting of Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela mean for the future of the oil industry?
If you're benefiting the U.S. economy, it's probably to the detriment of someone, potentially Venezuela.
I'm Juana Summers. We go to Texas, which has the most refining capacity in the United States, for answers on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday morning show here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Headwaters is our weekday music show connecting current trends to what has come before. Hear it Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and 10 p.m. And this morning you'll hear a live session with Longville folk singer Charlie Wagner at 10:15 this morning. Happy Dancing Turtle invites all ages to participate in their winter bingo scavenger hunt now until January 15th. Look for 24 items on your bingo card with a special focus on animal tracks. Find a registration link and more details at happydancingturtle.org. The city of Grand Rapids hosts an open house today from 4 to 6 at Yanmar Arena. Share your feedback on plans for American Legion Memorial Park. The Beltrami County Historical Society hosts a program with community members who have traced their families back to the American Revolution today at noon. Learn how they use genealogy and other documents to uncover stories of their ancestors. The Grand Rapids Area Library Fund has been established at the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. The goal is to raise $300,000 by September 1st. Funds will be earmarked for the library's 2027 budget. Beltrami Soil and Water Conservation District's annual tree sale is going on now. Young tree and shrub seedlings come in bundles of 25, plus native wildflower and grass mixes are available. Order early for the best selection. Find more info at beltramiswcd.org. It's the Back to Hack Festival in Hackensack, January 16th through the 18th. Activities include the Frostbite Your Fanny Fun Run, Snow Golf, Kids Games, Fireworks, and more. Find a full schedule at HackensackChamber.com. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer here on KAXE KBXE.
On today's date, January 14th, 1985, I catch a vole out running across the road. And by catching the vole, I mean I catch sight of it. And the vole is hoping that I am probably the only one to do so, because this is not the familiar place of a vole in winter. Typically, these animals are subnivian. That means they live under the snow, and they feel much more protected with a layer of snow on their backs and the concealment that it affords. Sometimes the snow will get extra crusty, and when they get on top, they're unable to find a way back underneath where, as I said, they feel much more protected. The vole, in this case, ran off the edge of the road and into the woods and approached a hazel brush stem that was protruding through the snow. And right where the snow and the hazel brush stem came together, there had been, because of the motion of the hazel brush, a little bit of disruption in the crust, and the vole was able to descend back to its happier grounds.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers unbox the unexpected over the holidays with British TV, including original series Linley and a new season of Karen Peary, streaming at BritBox.com. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, YPTC.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. We have updated data on how prices are rising in the United States. The Department of Labor's latest inflation report was out Tuesday, and it shows inflation was about the same from November to December.
NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Scott, so let's start with one section of the report. Nationally, gasoline might be getting cheaper at the pump, but what did the report say about other energy costs?
Well, they're generally going up. The Labor Department said yesterday natural gas prices are up more than 10% over the last year. Nearly half the country heats with natural gas, so that's driving up winter heating bills. We also use lots of natural gas to generate electricity, so those prices are climbing too. Mark Wolf heads a group of state agencies that help low-income families cover their energy cost, and he says about one out of six households is now falling behind on its utility bills.
We're hearing from families that we helped last year that need more help because the bill isn't going up. Then secondly, we're hearing from families who are working-class families who earn too much money to qualify for help, but are now finding these bills unaffordable.
Grocery prices were also up sharply last month, along with airfares and the price of clothing. Overall, the cost of living in December was up 2.7% from a year ago, the same annual inflation rate we saw in November. So we're kind of in a holding pattern.
Okay. Now, we know the high cost of living is a big concern for a lot of families, legitimately so. So how is the Trump administration handling that?
President Trump generally downplayed concerns about affordability in Michigan, where he gave an economic pep talk yesterday. Instead, he boasted about the strong GDP growth we saw this summer.
We have quickly achieved the exact opposite of stagflation, almost no inflation and super high growth.
Now, to be sure, GDP growth was strong in the third quarter, but it's not the case. We have almost no inflation. Prices are still going up faster than most people would like. What's more, that GDP growth has not come with a lot of new jobs. You know, the president toured a Ford Motor plant yesterday, but U.S. auto manufacturers lost 28,000 jobs last year. Manufacturing overall lost 75,000 jobs. So the economic picture is not quite as rosy as the president would like us to think.
Now, in a couple of weeks, the Federal Reserve is going to meet to talk about interest rates. The central bank has been getting a lot of pressure from the president to lower those rates. How is that working?
Yeah, the Fed is cutting interest rates, but not as quickly as Trump would like. Most forecasters think the Fed's going to hold rates steady when policymakers meet later this month because inflation is still too high. And yesterday's cost of living report just cemented that expectation. Trump wants much lower interest rates, and his administration's gone to extraordinary lengths to push the Fed in that direction. An ominous example came over the weekend with news the Justice Department had launched a criminal investigation of the central bank, which Fed Chairman Jerome Powell dismissed as an effort to intimidate him and his colleagues. Since then, a number of lawmakers and business people have come to Powell's defense, including the nation's top banker, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase.
So I just want to say that if I don't agree with everything the Fed has done, I do have enormous respect for Jay Powell, the man.
Dimon warned the White House pressure campaign could actually backfire if people start to think the Fed's independence is in jeopardy. It could ultimately lead to higher inflation and higher interest rates.
All right, that's NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's dive a little deeper into the numbers with Austin Goolsbee. He's president of the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank. So, Austin, I mean, what stood out to you in the latest inflation report?
Well, it didn't get worse, and that stood out. That's nice. Prices are on everyone's mind, but the showing that we're, let's say, on path headed back to 2% is an important challenge for us over the next couple of months.
I got to say, Austin, when you said it didn't get worse, I had to smile because does that qualify as good news now? It's not getting worse?
Yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily good news, but before the lights went out in the government shutdown, we had gotten some semi-disturbing reports, and we're wanting to get assurance that things were not getting worse. So maybe it's a bright lining in that.
All right, we'll have to live with that, I suppose. Wondering, what impact are President Trump's tariffs having on inflation?
I think it's pretty clear in the data that tariffs have increased the price of goods pretty significantly. That said, our hope is that over the coming months, you would see this one-time increase in costs be one and done, and that might go away. As I'm out here in the Midwest, and the Chicago Fed is the most manufacturing intensive of all the Fed districts in the country, it's still on the minds of business people and of community leaders. Their costs, their input costs, their costs that they're paying when they're going into the grocery store, that's still very much on people's mind. So if that tariff inflation proves to be more lasting than we hope, that would be a serious issue that we'd have to think about.
What are you going to be looking out for as the economy moves further into 2026?
The best thing about the economy is the growth rate remains pretty strong, and the powerful driver of growth in the economy is not actually AI data center investment. And those, yes, those are strong, but it is the continued spending of the American consumer. That's been the strongest part. So one thing I'm looking for is the consumer going to continue to be the driver of growth? And then on the inflation side, is there evidence that we're kind of putting this spike up in prices behind us?
You mentioned, Austin, you're wondering if consumers will drive growth. That, I would imagine, requires consumers to have confidence, investors to have confidence in the independence of the Federal Reserve Board. And now there's a big shadow hovering over the numbers because the Trump administration is apparently putting pressure on Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. So I'm wondering, what's your assessment of that situation and if that somehow will lead to having a lack of confidence in the independence of the Federal Reserve?
Well, there are a lot of moving parts to that question. The independence of the Fed couldn't be more important for the long-run inflation rate in this country. Any place where you don't have central bank independence, inflation comes roaring back. And we've spent the last 5 years fighting to get the inflation rate down, and that hasn't been easy. And if you're attacking the independence of the Fed, that makes that problem worse. And I will say, I consider Chair Powell to be a first ballot Hall of Fame Fed chair. And if we're going to get into a circumstance where the independence or even the integrity of Chair Powell is in question, we're in a bad spot.
That's Austin Goolsbee, president of the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank. Austin, thank you very much. Always appreciate you making time for us.
Yeah, great talking to you again.
This is NPR News.
In today's world of on-demand media streaming over the internet, one has to wonder, why does traditional radio still matter? I'm Steve Noy, IT and broadcast engineer for KAXE. Why do we work so hard to offer traditional broadcasting when people can just jump on the internet and get instant access? Well, here's why. KAXE is available to everyone in our listening area, no matter your financial or social status. Anyone with a radio can hear KAXE, and you get the same great experience whether you're a member, a business sponsor, or just hearing about us for the first time. We do stream on our website, but it doesn't take a costly internet connection to hear KAXE. That's why we're looking for your help. We serve the whole community, and we can't do that without you. Tell others about us, or text the word donate to 218-326-1234. KAXE is an equalizer, making great content available to you no matter who you are. KAXE is people-powered radio.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Check KAXE.org for information about food-related resources across northern Minnesota, with hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Add resources in your region by emailing news at kaxe.org. Itasca Curling Club in Grand Rapids is offering one more Learn to Curl session Friday, January 16th at 6 p.m. Wear comfortable clothing and bring in athletic shoes. Minnesota State Park offers free admission Monday, January 19th. There are 75 parks and recreation areas across the state, so you can visit an old favorite or explore somewhere new. United Way Bemidji is offering assistance to those affected by last summer's derecho. If you need repairs to your home or need help navigating insurance coverage, you can fill out a form at unitedwaybemidji.org or contact their office. The Cohasset Parks and Rec Department has snowshoe hikes at Tioga Recreation Area on Mondays and Thursdays at 1:30. Meet at the bike trail parking lot. The city will provide snowshoes if you don't have them. All experience levels welcome. And looking at the weather today, it should be a sunny day, highs 10 to 15 degrees, northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour, evening lows 6 below to 1 above.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In 1955, Rosa Parks famously refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery, Alabama bus. She was not the first. Months earlier, a black teenager, Claudette Colvin, was arrested for not offering her seat to a white passenger. Colvin has died at age 86, and NPR's Debbie Elliott is with us. Debbie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What was her story?
Well, this was back in March of 1955, and Colvin was just a 15-year-old high school student. She was riding in the back of a Montgomery bus where black passengers were supposed to be sitting when a white bus driver ordered her to give up her seat to a white woman. She refused. She told NPR in a 2009 interview that she'd paid her bus fare and had a right to her seat.
All I do remember is that I wasn't going to walk off the bus voluntarily.
Police were called in and took her off of the bus in handcuffs. So no, she did not walk off that bus voluntarily. She was jailed for violating bus segregation ordinances, disturbing the peace, and assaulting an officer. She remembered hearing the jail door slam and then crying behind bars before she was eventually bailed out. It would be 9 months later that Rosa Parks was arrested for the same thing, refusing to give up her bus seat. That act inspired the Montgomery bus boycott, famously led by an up-and-coming young pastor, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
Now, as I recall, people gave a lot of thought to the Rosa Parks case. Is this the perfect person to make this case to the country about segregation? But this makes me wonder, how was it that Colvin came to challenge the segregated bus system in Alabama before that?
This is what is so interesting to me. Colvin told NPR in that 2009 interview that she was inspired by what she had just learned during Black History Month in school and the students' discussions about the unjust conditions for black citizens in the Jim Crow South. Here's what she said.
Just like my head was just too full of black history. You know, the oppression that we went through. So I tell everybody, I say, you know what, how it felt? I said it felt like Sojourner Truth was on one side pushing me down and Harriet Tubman was on the other side of me pushing me down. I couldn't get up.
She felt the weight of that history on her shoulders.
Amazed to hear the way she expresses that, too, all those years later. So having heard this story, how should Claudette Colvin be remembered?
Well, even though she is lesser known than Rosa Parks, she was a key player in dismantling racial segregation in public transportation. Even as Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. were making waves and gaining international attention with the Montgomery bus boycott, Colvin was one of the plaintiffs in what became a landmark federal lawsuit filed by civil rights attorney Fred Gray. Her testimony was instrumental in that case. A federal court ruled bus segregation unconstitutional. The U.S. Supreme Court agreed. That was 1956. So she was certainly a teenage pioneer right there at the start of the civil rights movement. Gray has said that she gave the movement moral courage. She later moved to New York and worked as a nurse's aide and wasn't really recognized for her contributions until decades later. A book was written about her in 2009. In 2021, she got her juvenile arrest record expunged.
Amazing.
A memorial note on her foundation said she leaves a legacy of courage that helped change the course of American history.
And NPR's Debbie Elliott, always a pleasure hearing from you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Hi. Hi, I'm Elsa Chang from National Public Radio. We bring you the news and voices of people across the nation each and every day. We are proud of the work that we do, but we want to remind you that local affiliates like KAXE bring you the voices of your friends and neighbors. From arts reporting on area voices to local and state sports or clean energy and economic development, they reflect what life is like in rural northern Minnesota. Your support is critical to the work they do, where you learn about high school students in debate, to the sacredness of water and wild rice, to the history and future of forests in the region. Being a member makes this all possible, so please go to KAXE.org.
Microsoft says it will foot the bill for extra data center electricity costs.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Ninja One, helping organizations simplify endpoint management to automate IT and strengthen security all from one platform. More at ninjaone.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. The data centers needed to power AI are controversial in many communities. People are worried that the extra demand will drive up their electricity bills, which already are up 7% in a year on average, according to yesterday's inflation report. In response to this backlash, Microsoft is pledging to pay extra for electricity to power its data centers so regular people's electric bills don't get driven up. The tech giant also says it'll work to prevent water resources from being drained by giant server farms. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
Microsoft's announcement comes amid growing public backlash against data centers. That backlash has led to tens of billions of dollars in projects being delayed or canceled in recent months.
Communities are asking us hard and pointed questions about the impact of data centers.
Rima Alaili heads Microsoft's infrastructure legal affairs team.
Data centers are growing at a rapid scale, and it's something that is really new for communities to have to grapple with.
The biggest concerns have been rising electricity costs and the large amounts of water many data centers consume for cooling. Microsoft is promising, among other things, to pay the full cost of the electricity it consumes and to replenish more water than it uses.
When I look at the Microsoft plan, it almost aligns perfectly with the arguments that are often made against data centers in communities in Pennsylvania.
Chris Borick has seen the angry town hall meetings in his state from his perch as director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion.
If there's one particular aspect right now of where the issue is connecting to individuals, it's through their electricity prices.
President Trump highlighted Microsoft's electricity commitment and said his administration is talking to other data center builders to do the same. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all down in the 4 to 6 tenths% range, with Dow futures down 171 points. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is at 4.16%. Congress, under the Constitution, has the power to control the country's finances, and some lawmakers are trying to use that power to prevent the Trump administration from invading Greenland. Democrat Senator Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire and Republican Lisa Murkowski of Alaska have introduced legislation to bar the Pentagon and Department of State from using funds appropriated by Congress to, quote, blockade, occupy, annex, conduct military operations against, or otherwise assert control over the territory of a NATO member state.
Marketplace is supported by Ascendium Education Group, which is committed to making education and training after high school a reality for learners from low-income backgrounds. And by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
Venezuela's state-owned energy company has reportedly started to ramp up oil production again as exports of crude restart under U.S. supervision. That oil production had fallen close to zero after the U.S. imposed a blockade on oil shipments from the country. So what does a Venezuelan oil industry under U.S. control look like? And what does the oil market look like in that situation? So we put that question to Andrew Campbell. He's executive director at the Energy Institute at Haas at University of California, Berkeley. Welcome.
Thank you.
So President Trump declared that the U.S. would control indefinitely Venezuela's oil production. What would that actually mean, given the current market environment for oil?
Well, that's the piece where it's a very questionable whether this would be a good idea for the United States or any international oil companies. I mean, the global oil market right now is very well supplied. So that's good for consumers, good for oil consumers. The prices are modest. But for a country like Venezuela, whose oil reserves are some of the lowest quality oil reserves in the world, that's a really bad thing. Just producing it is very expensive due to the poor quality oil.
Yeah. I mean, in one post to social media, the president said a big factor in the U.S. involvement in Venezuela is the, quote, reduction of oil prices for the American people. Would that actually lower gas prices for people?
I mean, not anytime soon. I mean, there's a little bit of kind of a grain of an idea there, which is the Gulf Coast in the United States has tremendous refining capacity. Much of that capacity was built and expanded to process oil coming from Venezuela. So the refineries are able to produce gasoline, get it into the market, lower prices for consumers. But there are many other sources of oil too. And the biggest source actually is U.S. domestic oil. And that is why prices in part are low right now. It's hard to see how Venezuela really would have any impact on that, even if oil production increased substantially.
The president met with oil executives last week. ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, they have outstanding debts in Venezuela. At least one of the CEOs called Venezuela uninvestable. What would make Venezuela a profitable investment? What would make it investable?
So thinking back to the Venezuela of the past, the 1990s Venezuela was highly investable. There were many U.S. oil companies, other foreign companies operating very profitably in the country at that time. There were stable institutions. There were stable, understandable courts. So there was a whole framework that was basically friendly to international investment. That system is long gone, and it would take decades to probably put that back together.
President Trump said that Venezuela and the unlocking of its oil would create massive wealth, lower taxes, and create a lot of jobs for Americans and Venezuelans. What do you make of that?
You know, again, there's a little bit of something there. I mean, the Venezuelan oil industry had historically employed many, you know, tens of thousands of Venezuelans. So yeah, certainly a revitalized industry, if that were possible, would create jobs there in Venezuela. I don't really see how it would create jobs in the United States. The oil industry is not really a labor-intensive industry. It's a capital-intensive industry. It's really about, you know, making money for companies, for investors. It's not a big source of employment.
Andrew Campbell is executive director at the Energy Institute at Haas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Power Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Grand Rapids Tax Aid seeks volunteers for the upcoming tax season. They are looking for people to prepare taxes and those who'd rather help in other ways. Email taxaidgr@gmail.com. KBXE presents Skipalooza at Three Island Park in Bemidji, Saturday, January 24th, from noon to 3. Come to cross-country ski, snowshoe, fat tire bike, play music, or just swap stories around the fire. Bring some food to share for the potluck. The Winter Lecture Series continues at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, Saturday, January 17th at 1 p.m. Author Pete